On my altar at home, I have the Buddha, Jesus, and St. Francis all sitting next to each other, and they get along just fine. I'm technically Buddhist, was born and raised Jewish. My mantra is Hindu, and my morning meditation is the Catholic prayer, St. Francis of Assisi. Is anyone not familiar with the prayer of St. Francis? Okay, good. This is for you guys. I will share it with you the way it was originally intended, and then I'll tell you what I changed about it. I don't think St. Francis would mind. The prayer is addressed to God. Many people are not comfortable with the word God. I know I had a lot of resistance to it because of how I was raised. I already had my parents condemning everything I was doing. I didn't need one more figure. And so some people send their prayers out to Gus, God, universe, spirit, or whatever works for you. I have a friend who sends all his prayers out to Bob. But I acknowledge that within me there is good and then there is ego. And so when I pray, I address the good within me. It's not out to something outside of me. It's in here. And the prayer starts out by saying, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. Grant that I shall not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, or to be loved as to love. For it's in giving that we receive, it's in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it's in dying to this idea, this concept of a separate self, that we are born to eternal life. And I love that prayer. I've been sitting with it since I was 16 years old, but I misunderstood it for the first many years. I also felt, I don't know if it's because English is my second language or what, but something about it bothered me. It was supposed to empower me first thing in the morning to sit there with that prayer. And I would sit there every day and say, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. I was essentially saying, I'm not. So I started every day from a place of lack. Please, please make me something that I'm not. It's like praying for strength. It's just another way to say, I don't have any. And so I like saying, thank you for the strength, which acknowledges you have it and lets you tap it to its unlimited supply. So instead of saying, make me an instrument of your peace, I tried one morning to say, I am an instrument of your peace. And that felt so heavy. It was scary. And I didn't know what to do. I was like, an instrument of God's peace. Oh my gosh, that feels like a really big job. How do I even go about doing that? And I was like, relax, Timber. The prayer goes on. Where there's hatred, sow love. Where there's injury, pardon. Where there's doubt, faith. Where there's despair, hope. I was like, okay, there's instructions. Good. But I still misunderstood them. I thought my job was to go out in the world and wherever there was hatred, sow love. Where there's injury, pardon. To fix the world out there. So I changed it yet again. And I added the word within. Where there's hatred within, I shall sow love. Where there's injury within, I should pardon. It's all in here. This is all I can fix. And that became, is still is, a lifelong process. In the Buddhist monastery, we woke up every morning and we still say, greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly. I vow to abandon them. So in the same prayer, we acknowledge that greed, hatred, and ignorance are going to continue to come up, and yet I'm going to continue to vow to abandon them. It's like making your bed in the morning, or I know the weeds are going to grow in the yard again, but I'm going to pull them when they do. It's always going to happen, right? So there's a lot of work in here. And the reason the latest book is called The Opposite of Namaste, which really confuses some people. Namaste is typically defined, it's a greeting, and it's typically defined as the God within me or the good within me or the divinity within me recognizes, acknowledges, and honors the divinity within you, right? It's easy to do when you're standing in front of someone who is kind and loving and patient and generous, and you're like, oh, namaste, I see the God in you. But what happens when you're standing in front of a jerk? It becomes really difficult to be like, namaste, jerk. But I've been a jerk before. I've been rude before. I've been short-sighted before and hurtful, either deliberately or unintentionally. And so when I watch someone do something that I either don't agree with or don't understand or I think is harmful or whatever it is, I go, oh, the ego in me recognizes the ego in you. Now, to be clear, this is not something we say out loud. This is internally when I witness someone go, why are they doing this? It's like, well, they think it's going to lead to them being happy. They're doing it for the same reason you're doing what you're doing. And immediately it eliminates judgment. You no longer judge them. You get them. You see them at eye level and you go, the ego in me sees you. The God in me loves the whole of you, ego and all. You're just, what I love about Buddhism is it invites us to not just honor everyone's path, but meet people wherever they currently are on the path. And so I can see them and I can go, I get it. This is where you are right now. And there's no judgment. And for as far back as time goes, singers, songwriters, poets, philosophers, they've all tried to define love. And I think the Dalai Lama nailed it when he said, love is the absence of judgment. It's that simple. Love is the absence of judgment. If you're wondering what's standing between you and being able to love the person in front of you, it's judgment. Or even if it's what's between you and being able to love yourself, it's judgment. And when you remove judgment, all that's left is love. So we don't need to work really hard to love everyone and just remove judgment and you'll be left at our what I think is our inherent state, which is loving. That is who we are. We are love. We are peace. We don't need to find who we are. We're not lost like loose change between the couch cushions. We need to create who we are. And I think it's our responsibility. And mindfulness to me is the gap between impulse and response. When I lead guided meditations, because I don't like guided meditations. I've read the books. They're like, sit, you know, with in full lotus position with your eyes either closed or at a 45 degree angle. With your hands like this, breathing out of this nostril and out of that. I'm like, forget it, I can't. And so many people come to me and they go, I don't know how to meditate, I'm doing it wrong. And the only reason people feel like they're doing it wrong is because at some point, somewhere along the way, someone told them there's a right way to do it. So when I do start my monthly discussion groups or anything like that, I always just say, just sit for 3 minutes. Don't worry about what's going on in your brain. Don't try to control your thoughts. Just don't physically move. That's it. Just feel the urge to itch. Don't scratch. Feel like there's a spider crawling on your head. There isn't. And even if there is, the only place that didn't work is Australia. Because if there's a spider on your head in Australia, move. but anywhere else, it's usually your mind playing tricks on you because you're trying to get it to sit still and it doesn't know how to do that. It's very reactionary. And so the point of sitting there still for 3 minutes and feeling like, oh my gosh, there's sweat dropping down my face. I want to rub it or I want to fix my hair. Well, not my hair, but you know what I mean. You know, the point is not to congratulate yourself at the end of 3 minutes, like, good job, you didn't move. It's you're exercising the muscle of feeling the impulse and not acting on it. And we can use that throughout the day, online or in conversations with our in-laws, to feel the impulse to say something and just not say it. It doesn't need to be said. I don't know. Well, the only thing I know for certain is that I don't know anything for certain. So I don't argue with anyone about anything. I just listen. It's a lot easier that way. If somebody comes to me and tells me the sky is purple and I believe it to be blue, I don't need to argue with them. I don't need to get 10 of my friends on my side to go, look, they all agree with me. I don't need to go, hey, Alexa, what color is the sky? I don't need to prove them wrong in order to feel right or to make myself superior by making them inferior. Yogananda called it feeling tall by cutting off the heads of other men. I don't need to do that. Somebody tells me the sky is purple, and I can walk away from that conversation with a newfound knowledge that to some people, the sky looks purple. How much easier would life be? And I think I can do that because I'm confident in my blue sky. So the blueness of my sky is not jeopardized by how green or purple they perceive it to be. Now, if I'm not confident with what I know or believe or my choices, then I need the outside validation in order to feel secure with myself. So I don't argue with anyone about anything. I cannot be responsible for other people's opinions or reactions, but I am responsible for mine. I mentioned earlier today that I was in a guided meditation exercise in a large room, and we were all asked to close our eyes and think back to a really sad memory from our lifetime, whatever that may be. And that could be the moment that someone close to you passed away. It could be the moment your dog ran away. It could be the moment you had your heart broken or you're going through a divorce, whatever sad moment comes to mind. And as we were sitting there and we thought about it and we were guided more deeply into the memory, like who was with you at the time, what were you wearing, the sounds, the colors, the textures of the moment, you can see from the back of the room, everyone's posture started to slouch. As we thought of that sad memory, some people started tearing and crying as if they were going through it all over again. And then we were asked to think back of the happiest memory of our life, whatever that may be. Could be your wedding day, could be the day you got divorced. I don't know what your happy memory is, but the moment we thought of the happy memory, everyone's posture straightened up, and some people started smiling and giggling to themselves. The power behind that exercise was that we were in complete control of how we feel. Through nothing more than the power of our thought, we just went from being sad to being happy. And yet, so many of us go through life constantly playing the victim, saying, I can't help the way I feel, poor me. Or worse yet, you make me feel ... We take our power, our responsibility, and we give it to someone else. It's not their job. It's not their responsibility. And if you don't give them that power, it's not their ability either. This is your power. You can say something really offensive to me, and then I have the choice, if I practice that sitting with it, to either be offended or not. But the choice is mine. And it's very empowering to keep that power rather than give it away. Does that make sense? And it's in our language. We constantly say, I can't help the way I feel, or I have to. These are all ways of identifying as a victim. And then we feel stuck. And when we blame someone else for doing something, we often go to them to try to fix it, which is really kind of interesting when you think about it. Because that's the last person who has any vested interest in consoling you or comforting you. I realized this. I grew up in a very violent household, and scarier than the fact that it was violent, it was unpredictably violent. So I never knew if I was coming home to a hug or a beating. It could be, and that makes home a very scary place to come to. But I also grew up watching a lot of Who's the Boss? Do you remember Who's the Boss? With Alyssa Milano and Tony Danza. I had a huge poster of Alyssa Milano above my bed, right next to Axl Rose, very confused adolescence. And in the TV show, it didn't matter how angry Tony got at Alyssa, by the end of the episode, he would go into her room, he would say, I'm really sorry, she would say, I'm really sorry, and it would make up, it'd all be great. And so it didn't matter how badly my parents beat me, I waited in my room for them to come and comfort me, the same people who hurt me. And we go through life doing this all the time. And even in school, if the bully hurts you, the teacher pulls the bully by the ear and makes the bully apologize to you. They have no interest in apologizing to you. But we keep going to the same people who break us to come back and comfort us. This is our job, guys. If we don't heal from what hurt us, we end up bleeding on people who didn't cut us. It's up to us to do the healing and be the adult we needed as a child, if that makes sense. So it's our responsibility. Just like in that meditation, we can choose how we feel. As we go through life, we can choose how to respond rather than react to what is happening. And it's in that pause. That's what mindfulness to me is, just the pause in that impulse. And what we do in that pause, Gandhi defined happiness as when what you think, what you say, and what you do are all in harmony. They're all in alignment. Well, how can you live in alignment with your core values if you don't even know what they are? If you go to any website, any company, even here this morning, we talked about, here are our core values. Here's our mission statement. Here's our vision statement. You can visit any website, any company. Doesn't matter if it's a church or Walmart. And they'll tell you, here's our core values. And we as society expect them to operate in alignment with their values, right? No one's upset with Walmart for not being altruistic. They never claimed to be altruistic. Right? They just said, we're going to sell you the cheapest stuff possible at the lowest price possible at any cost. Like, we don't care if children made it. We don't care if it's toxic. We're going to sell it to you, and we're going to sell it to you cheap. And then we have the choice to either shop there or not. And it's like, fair enough. You're doing exactly what you said you're going to do. Right? So that's in alignment. That's in harmony. But if someone who's vegan shows up in a leather jacket and they tell you what you should and shouldn't eat, we go, wait a minute. Right? Nothing wrong with being vegan, nothing wrong with wearing a leather jacket, but don't say one thing and doing another, right? And you know how to tell if someone's vegan, right? They'll tell you. So the invitation is, go home, write down your core values, write down your mission statement, your vision statement. If you had a website, your first name, last name.com, what would your core values be? And are you living in line with them? Or are you saying one thing and doing another? Because when you do that, you're creating internal conflict. And then you're living internally conflicted, which as a result means you're going to live in conflict with everyone around you. But when you're at peace with yourself, oh, so much easier to live at peace with others. I remember being at a food court in LA, and this woman who was clearly an environmentalist saw this guy throw his soda can in the trash instead of the recycling bin. And he was right next to it. You know, it's LA. It was garbage, recycle, compost, all right there. And she lost it right there in the food court. She's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Don't you care about the environment? Don't you? And he looked at her and he said, lady, I just had a bacon double cheeseburger with a Pepsi. I'm about to smoke another cigarette. Clearly, I don't care about my own health. What makes you think I give up about the environment? And I love that honesty, right? It's like, meet people where they are. If you care that much, move that soda can from the trash to the recycling bin, go home, feel better about yourself. But the moment you push your views on someone else, you're pushing them away. Just let your life be your message. When I left the monastery, you know, at first I was in full robes for a long time. And the robes made perfect sense in the monastery because we all wore the same thing. We all had the same haircut. And we were all one. And so how we were living was in direct correlation to what we believed, that we're all in this together. We're all the same. But when I left the monastery, because even when you go, they tell you the goal isn't for you to make this your home. It's to take what you learn, and then if you can be peaceful in the middle of LA traffic, that's the goal, not here. Here it's easy, or easier, I should say. So when I left the monastery, I was still in robes. And while the robes made perfect sense in the monastery, because they communicated, I'm like everyone else, wearing them outside the monastery communicated the exact opposite. It said, look at me, I'm different from you. And people started treating me differently, which is the exact opposite of what I was going for. I remember this old lady on the bus offered me her seat. And I said, no, it was the opposite results. And I said, my own teachers asked me, Timber, why the robes? Why can't you just be the guy in town with the bright eyes? And that is the invitation for all of us. Go home, write down what your core values are, live in line with them. What's your mission statement? What's your vision statement? Be the person in town with the bright eyes through your actions. Don't give a lecture to someone who needs a hug. Everyone is struggling with something. How they show up is how they show up. Who are you in relation to what shows up in front of you? If you believe yourself to be compassionate and kind and peaceful, be compassionate and kind and peaceful. That's your invitation. And they'll say, yeah, well, they started it. We're adults. I think it's our responsibility to act like that. So I didn't always act this way. I wasn't born into a monastery or monkhood. I was a paralegal for 10 years right here in San Francisco. And one day, one of the other paralegals was celebrating her 30-year anniversary. And the fact that she celebrated 30 years in a cubicle was just terrifying to me. Good for her, but you know, like I got a glimpse of my future and I said, no thanks. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew right there and then what I didn't want. And I think knowing what you don't want is an equally helpful navigation tool. So I sold everything I ever owned, everything I worked so hard to build up to project the image of success, the condo, the sports car, the designer clothes, the designer furniture, I got rid of all of it. And I moved to Hawaii with just a backpack and a volleyball net because at the time, that's what was most important to me. And I didn't know what I wanted, but I knew what I didn't want. And one thing led to another. I ended up living in a monastery, then moved to another monastery, then to a lay practitioner's temple. And of course, you can imagine when I sold everything and quit my job, everyone freaked out, my family, my friends. And I said, don't worry, I'll send you a letter every month to let you know what's going on with me. And after 8 years of this, my best friend said, you know those letters you've been sending us? You need to compile them and like publish them as a book or something. And I said, who's going to want to read that? And she said, that's not for you to decide. You publish it, people will decide if they want to read it. So almost on a dare, I published it. And it spread like wildflowers. It just became this international bestseller in multiple languages. It became required reading in high schools in California. I was living in my little temple room in Hawaii. I had no idea any of this was going to happen. It just spread, and I started being invited to speak at schools. It became available in all the prisons all over the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia, and so all of a sudden I'm speaking in the basement at a prison in the U.K. It's like, how did this happen? Because when you take a vow to be of service, you don't know what that's going to show up like. You just say, I'm here to be of service. I don't know what that's going to look like. And it brought me here today. This isn't where I want to be on the beach playing volleyball. But when you take a vow to be of service, you leave you behind. That last line in the prayer, it's in dying to self that we are born to eternal life. When I give up on this me as somehow separate from others and decided to serve we instead of me, life opened up. And every day when I wake up, I'm like, oh, I guess we're doing this again. None of us know that we're going to be here tomorrow, but if you woke up today and you're here, it's not necessarily because you need it today. It may be because someone needs you. And so I think it's about removing ourselves from the center of the universe, which I'm sure one day scientists are going to discover what's at the center of the universe, and many people will be so disappointed to find out it's not them. So we are going to meet back here at 2:00 today. We're going to have like a circle discussion of sorts where I don't know what's going to happen, but we're going to talk about the difference between feelings and emotions, the disparity between truths and facts, this ego self that's going through life white-knuckling. It's free to anyone. You can come, you can join. It's a discussion. I don't know what's going to... I don't even know what I said this morning or if how this was different. It doesn't matter. But there's always something to learn. I think as long as we identify as students, we will see lessons and teachers everywhere. But if you think you already have the answers, don't come. Because I'll only have questions. And if you show up with an open heart and open mind, I'm sure you will leave full and ready to spill over. Thank you guys so much.